from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on this morning's Forum program, a longtime food critic for The New York Times and former editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine, Ruth Reichel, has just released her debut novel. But Reichel is navigating familiar territory in Delicious, in which a food writer discovers a stash of World War II-era letters between a 12-year-old girl and the legendary chef James Beard. Ruth Reichel joins us to discuss her post-gourmet career and her foray into fiction and talk with us about food. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. One of the nation's leading food critics and food writers, Ruth Reichel, covered that terrain for New West, the LA Times, and the New York Times before becoming editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine for a decade. The author of three memoirs, Tender at the Bone, Comfort Me with Apples and Garlic and Sapphire, she recently published her first novel. It's called Delicious, and she joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. And so good to have you back.
It's great to be here.
Well, you know, the last time you were here, you were talking with your usual enthusiasm and vitality about Gourmet magazine and about the nearly million readers and so forth, and how you love being editor-in-chief and working with all the people that you were working with. The day after.
It was the day after,
and I thought, poor Ruth, what is she going through here? And those of you who don't know what we're talking about here, Gourmet magazine just had the rug pulled out from under them, and you were completely sideswiped by that, weren't you?
I was completely taken. I never saw it coming, not for a minute. And, you know, it was very strange because I was on tour for the Gourmet Cookbook. And I went from San Francisco to Seattle, and I got this call in Seattle, you have to come back to New York. And I said, no, I'm going to Portland next. And they said, no, you need to come back. And I even then did not imagine that they were closing the magazine. I mean, I thought maybe they were going to fire me, but not that they would close the magazine.
Kind of depressed you, didn't it?
Oh, it was terrible. I mean, yeah. I mean, look, I mean, here's a magazine that lasted 69 years and it closes on my watch. 60 people lost their jobs. The readers loved that magazine, and I felt, you know, that I had somehow let everyone down.
It was not only a foodie magazine, though. I mean, one of the things I liked about it was it got into a lot of political stuff. I mean, took up a lot of other issues related to food, but, you know, all over the map, really.
Yeah, no, I was very fortunate. I mean, when I went there, I said, I think it's time for an Epicurean magazine to take a much larger bite of the world. I don't just want to cover recipes and restaurants and nice trips. I really want to talk about the food system. I want to lead the conversation in this country about what's happening to what we eat and its culture, its politics, its agriculture. And we're going to cover all that. And they let me do that. And they let me, you know, hire the best writers, David Foster Wallace, Juno Diaz, Ann Patchett. I mean, we had an extraordinary run, I think. I'm very proud of what we did. You know, a story about the tomato pickers in Florida who were living in slavery. And, you know, we covered difficult issues.
You also said after you left that cooking saved your life. So you're not at all like your protagonist here, Billy Breslin, like in Jimmy, who's afraid of cooking, who actually has a phobia about cooking.
Right. She is someone who has a perfect palate, which I wish I did. So I gave it to her. But she's had this terrible tragedy in her life. And it has shut her down completely. I mean, she's in a shell and she is unable to cook. I mean, she literally cannot go into the kitchen without, you know, starting to faint.
It's a novel about a family tragedy, but it also brings in kind of a couple of mysteries and World War II and James Beard and all sorts of things. And I really, you know, admire the fact that you've staked out this new territory for yourself. I mean, I think it takes guts to, especially when you've had one success after another writing essentially memoirs, to say, I'm going to write a novel.
Well, I love fiction. It is my first love. I grew up in publishing. My father was a book designer. He always brought home galleys of books that he loved that when he was designing them. In the house I grew up in, fiction was really, you know, the highest calling. And I always thought I wanted to write a novel. And my basic belief is when something terrible happens to you, do something really hard. Do something you're not sure you can do. Push yourself. And that was, you know, here I was. I'd lost this great love that I had, the magazine. And I thought, okay, now is the time. I'm going to see if I can do this.
Didn't your mother's Everything Stew start you cooking?
Yeah, well, it did. My mother was truly the world's worst cook. My earliest memory is watching her go through the refrigerator, scraping the blue stuff off the top and saying, a little mold never hurt anyone. And her favorite dish was Everything Stew, which was literally everything in the refrigerator mushed up, stuck into the oven, and served. And at a very young age, I thought, I can do better.
So when you say you've always had this love for fiction, what novelists were you particularly drawn to, or are you drawn to? I mean, you mentioned a couple of good ones, Ann Patchett and Junot Diaz. Are they mainly contemporary novelists you still read? Or?
No, I mean, I read everything. I've lately been rereading all of George Eliot, who astonishes me.
Me too.
It's a completely different thing to read her now than it was to read her in college. Mm-hmm. I love Hilary Mantel is a big favorite of mine. Probably the fiction writer I admire most right now is George Saunders, who is just a wonder.
He's just a wonderful guy. I mean, we've had him on here a few times, and he's just as nice as can be, really, as a person.
And you can tell that from, I mean, he's kind and he has this dystopian vision that is unlike anybody else's, but he's very generous with his characters. He's very modest as a writer.
And inventive.
And yes. I just love his writing. But, you know, I kind of, you know, read anything that comes my way.
Well, I guess also love Dan Barber. I was just thinking about him because did you read the piece he had in the Sunday New York Times about From Farm to Table, chance?
I didn't, but I imagine it's a piece that comes out of his new book.
Probably.
Which is a book that I enormously admire. Dan is the most articulate of the people we have now writing about food. And he asks the kinds of questions that we should be asking. I mean, he goes beyond the obvious. And his newest idea is that forget farm to table, it should be seed to table.
Yeah, that's essentially what he says in the article. Also, the fact that, you know, farms are being hurt terribly and they're disappearing.
They are disappearing, and we should really worry about that. And, I mean, his new book, The Third Plate, The Future of Food, I think should be required reading for everybody who eats.
Talking to famed food critic and now novelist. How's that sound to you, by the way?
Fantastic.
Ruth Reichel, author of Delicious, which has a lot to do with food, but a lot to do with life and family and much more to it. I think you were one of the first ones that made me realize to what extent a lot of these hot cuisine people can be really snobbish and almost kind of insufferably snobbish.
That was part of my purpose as a critic, was to try and bring this whole food thing down to earth. I'm very proud of the fact that I was known at the New York Times as a democratizing voice. Someone who said, you know, we forget about just the great restaurants. Let's eat everywhere. Let's eat on the street. Let's look at little noodle shops and.
Yeah, and I mean, that's part of your legacy. But you said you don't have a perfect palate like Billy. Palate's pretty good, to put it mildly. Outstanding, I think, would be my word to describe it. Talk about different palates for a moment with you. That fascinates me because I'm always arguing that I have different taste buds than most people because I think I do. It's not to say I have a good palate. It's just that, you know, I have sort of a peasant's palate, really, you know, meat and potatoes and that sort of thing. I think there are really different taste buds for people.
Well, I mean, that when I was a restaurant critic, that was one of the things I kept trying to emphasize to people. We are talking about what I'm tasting, and we have no way of knowing whether anybody else tastes the way we taste. There's just, you know, I mean, when you're critiquing a movie, you know that everybody's seeing the same movie. They may appreciate it in different ways, but at least they're seeing the same movie, reading the same book. When you're talking about flavor, we have absolutely no way of knowing whether we're tasting the same thing. And, you know, part of it is cultural. Part of it is, I believe, genetic. You know, we grow up eating different things, but we also I know that I have blind spots in my palate. I mean, there are certain herbs that I cannot, you know, the kind of mint basil family, distinguishing between many of those is just difficult for me. On the other hand, I have an almost painful acuity for rancidity. I mean, I can taste rancidity, you know, probably 2 weeks before anybody else knows that things are going bad.
Again, we're talking to Ruth Reichel, and her new novel is called Delicious. And I should mention, I guess this is a form of promotion, that Daniel Patterson is slated to be on with us tomorrow, who has Qua here in San Francisco and has written a book also. Something interesting to me sometimes how things cluster, and we had Michael Bauer on last week. It's not necessarily a foodie show, but it's certainly a show that's concerned with just about everything of interest, and food is clustering this last week or so. Why are so many chefs of my particular gender, though? I mean, you know, Julia Child and all those famous names notwithstanding, they're mostly men. They remain mostly men.
That's a big question and something that women are talking about a lot. And, I mean, there are a lot of reasons for it. But I think one of the big reasons is that women who go into this business suddenly – go into this business – women who become – professional chefs at about 35 start realizing that, you know, being a chef is punishing work. The hours are really long. It is really hard to have a family and be a full-time chef. And every chef needs a wife. And we really have to figure out a way to make not just this work, but, you know, any kind of CEO work. I mean, the kind of, you know, really long hours. It's the same question, you know, why are so many CEOs men?
Or why are so many talk show hosts men?
Well, yeah.
Or professional baseball players. Or, I mean, you know, it's all kind of provocative in different ways, depending on what it is. You're always looking for new recipes, aren't you?
Of course I am.
Yeah.
Of course I am.
So have you found any recently that you particularly are enthusiastic about?
Well, you know, I find new recipes by eating... You know, I go to restaurants and eat something and it's so delicious that I figure out I'm going to have to figure out how to make this. I mean, I was at Catonia last night, late at night, and Michael was making these suckling pig ravioli that were one of the most delicious things I've ever eaten in my life. And I have to figure out how to make that.
You couldn't ask him for his recipe? Trade secret or what?
Well, it's sort of more fun to try and figure it out for yourself.
How much do you eat? I'm just wondering this because I remember reading an interview where you said it's terrible that people feel they have to avoid butter and carbs because, you know, because they taste good. And I remember actually an interview years ago, I happened to interview Julia Child and Jacques Pepin, and she was, you know, talking about how wonderful steak is and meat, particularly hamburgers, things of that sort, and saying it almost with a kind of bravado, like, how can people be shocked by this when these things taste so good? We've gotten to the point now where certain foods almost seem verboten, and I'm not talking about for political reasons, but, you know, health reasons, carbs, sweets, well, butter. Yeah.
Well, there's actually a wonderful new book that's just out by someone who wrote for Gourmet for quite a while called The Big Fat Surprise, which is absolute proof that everything we think about fat is wrong. In fact, fat is fine for you. And we should be eating fat. I mean, I think as long as you're eating real food, you shouldn't avoid anything. I mean, the problem is that we eat so much invented, industrialized food, and that's what's really bad for us. But, you know, if you're getting good food from a farm, from a great market, eat anything. Eat what, you know, eat a great variety. Eat what you like. Enjoy your life. I mean, it's very short.
Now, when you talk about, again, some of the we'll get back to the novel, of course, but you talk about some of the political sides of food and wanting to bring that out in gourmet and everything. For quite some while, you've been talking about wanting to change the ways government subsidizes food.
Well, I think
it's been a passionate sort of cause celeb for you, hasn't it?
It is indeed, because we subsidize, our tax dollars subsidize all the wrong things. We subsidize big agribusiness. And we don't subsidize small farmers, who we should be subsidizing if we're going to subsidize anyone. But, you know, when you go to a fast food restaurant and a hamburger is cheaper than a salad, that's because that hamburger is subsidized by our tax dollars. And that's just crazy. I mean, it's crazy that a hamburger is cheap and a salad is not. And we really need to change that. I think another thing that we really need to do is stop allowing big companies to advertise to children. I mean, they are sitting ducks. They are sitting there in front of their TVs having these ads blasted at them, making them want to eat foods that we now know are bad for them. And, you know,
but, you know, of course, the countervailing argument to that is always, you know, free speech and how can you police and, you know, you're trying to decide what is appropriate for some people and what is not appropriate and that slippery slope, et cetera.
Well, that was the same argument that the cigarette people used. And
no, they just lied blatantly about it.
Well, but we now know that sugar is terrible for you. I mean, that's not in dispute. We know that that's the case. And, you know, we're letting these kids be, you know, become addicted to sugar. It's not right.
Have you read Bob Lustig's stuff or seen some of his things that have gone viral? He was on the cover of the New York Times Sunday magazine, a local professor of medicine.
Well, yeah. I mean, there was a wonderful book written by, you know, the former, Surgeon General David Kessler a few years ago about—
We actually featured it on this program.
Yeah, and I know him a little bit, and I think it's very persuasive that we are being addicted to fat, salt, and sugar. And we should care enough about our kids that we don't allow that addiction to continue.
I'm glad to get you.
Here.
I like those hobby horses, and so do many of our listeners, although some may give you some blowback on this one. Never knows. I saw an article you did on Soylent. Could we talk about that for a moment? Because
sure.
It suggests maybe people are going to give up the table altogether or something along those lines, at least the way you saw it.
Well, you know, I did this forum with a bunch of people who had been living on Soylent for a while. And, you know, the notion that you don't have time to eat is crazy to me. I mean, I think that the time that we spend at the table is really important. And it's not because of what's on the table. It's because we're sitting around the table. And the notion that we're all just going to sit in our little cubicles and drink our nutrition, I mean, you know, take a pill. It's making us more and more robotic. And I think that we really need to appreciate that the time spent at the table is very precious. I mean, that is how we became socialized, civilized animals, was sharing food.
Brings us right to your novel in some ways, because you and Michael Pollan, I know, are both strong advocates of family eating together and actually sitting at the table and breaking bread together as a family or whatever. And the whole sense of World War II, I guess people had to do that because of rationing to a great extent. Yeah.
I was fascinated by World War II and wanted to make it one of the central parts of the book because it's the only time that everyone in this country was sitting down at the same table. Didn't matter whether you were rich or poor. Eating was a patriotic duty, and eating frugally, saving your fat, eating on rations, raising a victory garden. I mean, that was all part of what the people here on the home front were doing. And, you know, in a time when we now have this crazily bifurcated food system where rich people and poor people are eating completely differently, I really wanted to examine this one time in American history where food was central to everything that was going on in the nation.
You even got into some of those World War II recipes, which are not necessarily too appetizing.
Well, that's true.
And what is it about gingerbread? Let's talk about that, right at the center of your novel almost.
It is the center. I mean, gingerbread, well, for two reasons. I mean, one, you know, there is nothing lifted pinky about gingerbread. There's no way it can be pretentious. But it's also seems to me that of all the recipes that I can think of, the sort of homey recipes I can think of, it's the one that cried out the most to be rethought with new ingredients. I mean, why not make gingerbread with fresh ginger and lots of spices and all these spices we can get now? And so I really wanted to reimagine that recipe.
Getting some emails. In fact, I'll give out the phone number in just a moment and invite listeners to join us. Of course, you can join us by email. Just forum@kqed.org or go right to our website if you have comments or questions for Ruth Reichel. And that's kqed.org/forum and click on the segment. Here's David in Menlo Park who says, I just saw and really enjoyed Chef. That's a new movie about food trucks starring John Leguizamo and John Favreau. I wonder if Ruth Reichel has seen it and had any comments. I thought the food, cooking, and kitchen scenes were beautiful and lovingly portrayed.
I get asked this question all the time. I have been on book tour since the movie came out.
Haven't had time.
So I have not had a moment to go to the movies.
Well, what do you think about the whole food truck phenomenon?
I love it. I mean, you know, it's very much like fashion. You know, fashion, haute couture, used to start at the top and trickle down to the people. And now it starts from the street and goes up. And that's what's happening with food now is the big food trends are starting on the street and going up to the fancy restaurants. And, you know, I love the notion that you get to actually take food from the hand of the person who's making it and that, you know, ordinary people can just, you know, make some great dish and go out on the street and sell it. I think it's fantastic.
Can we feel comforted by the sanitation?
You know, I don't worry about that too much.
Don't think about it when you're in a restaurant at all.
No, I don't. And I actually think that you're probably safer in a restaurant and a food truck than you are from some home cook who doesn't know that they have to worry about cutting vegetables where they cut the chicken.
Talking again with Ruth Reichel. And let me invite those of you listening to join us. You can do that right now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. If you have questions or comments or recipes, please feel free to join us. Again, the toll-free number, 866-733-6786. And as I said, you can also join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum. Just read an email here, a love note. There are very few authors with whom I'm unable to maintain at least a degree of objectivity. Ruth Reichel is certainly one of them. Her memoirs are my absolute favorite depictions of a well-lived life as a lover of both good food and eating well. I'm especially fond of her very theatrical stories of life at the New York Times as a New York Times reviewer, but I must admit I'm still hot under the collar about Gourmet's Folding. Under Reichel, that magazine reached its absolute pinnacle of excellence in food journalism, and there simply has not been any competing publication that stepped up to fill that gap. The publishing world has become increasingly and tediously prey to the bean counter mentality. Whatever happened to the idea of keeping a legendary publication around simply because it's become a valuable part of our culture? We've lost one of the all-time greats with Gourmet and its fine editor-in-chief.
Oh, isn't that nice?
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Ruth Reichel is with us, author of a new novel called Delicious, former restaurant critic for the New York Times, and former editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine. Her other books include Tender at the Bone and Not Becoming My Mother and other things she taught me along the way, her mother who is also from Cleveland. And tonight she'll be at the Commonwealth Club, 7 o'clock at the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto, both places tonight, tomorrow at Omnivore Books. I like that name, huh? 6:30 in San Francisco, and you can join us. In fact, you're welcome to do that if you have questions or comments for Ruth Reichel, or as I said, any new recipes you'd like to put in the mix here. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, and let's bring a caller on. That's Ying. Good morning.
Hi. Ms. Reichel, have you ever considered putting a vegan version of each of your recipes in your books?
I have not. It would be pretty impossible to do a vegan version of each of my recipes. I have to admit that there's a lot of animal products and eggs and butter. It would be a different book. I would have to completely reimagine all the recipes.
But there are a lot of good vegan cookbooks out there and good books about vegan eating and so forth. In fact, we featured, did a whole program on vegetarian vegan eating on Forum, which I think is in our archives for those interested. And Ying, thank you for the call. Let's talk a little bit about, you've been in New York now for a number of years, but you still love San Francisco restaurants. And there are certainly things that are done in San Francisco and the Bay Area far superior to New York and vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about the Bay Area is the products that you have access to here are so fantastic. You're surrounded by these really wonderful small farms, and you get, fish right out of the sea and great West Coast oysters. And so you start with a real advantage here, I think. There's also a kind of spirit of adventure here that is getting harder and harder to have in New York. As rents go up in New York.
They're going up here too.
It's harder for experimental restaurants to open up. So you'll have something like a Mission Chinese will open in San Francisco, and then only after it's been wildly successful here does Danny come to New York and open one in New York. But I don't think he could. It couldn't have worked the other way around. He couldn't have opened in New York, and they're that kind of wild, small. I mean, I'm thinking about, like, last time I was here, I went to Atelier Crenn and had absolutely fantastic meal that was experimental or something like quoi. Hard to do in New York, where there's probably a bigger quotient of pretension. Hard to do these kind of small, wonderful places. I mean, or someplace like, Boulette's Larder, that is just, a very particular kind of flavor. And you just don't get that much in New York.
Do you get milkweed?
The milkweed in the book was, I mean, I thought if I was cooking during World War II, I would have foraged, because it's all there, right? And I went and took a foraging class and discovered that milkweed is edible in all of its forms. I mean, there's a reason why monarch butterflies love this stuff. You can eat the shoots, which are kind of like asparagus. You can eat the immature pods. And you can eat the floss, which is this beautiful, white, fluffy stuff that tastes a little like cheese.
What kind of cheese?
not an aged cheese, like an immature cheese.
Did you actually met James Beard?
Hmm? Oh, yeah.
Plays in this novel, has a significant role in the novel, yeah.
I met James Beard, and he was my dear friend Marion Cunningham was his longtime assistant. So I met him many times through her. And, I thought that if there had been any writer who had gotten these letters from Lulu, the little girl in my book, who said, "Help, I'm trying to cook for my mother. These rationing recipes are terrible. Help me." James Beard would have answered without any doubt. I also have to say that as a novelist, I loved the notion of we never actually hear from – he looms very large in the book. He's a big character in the book, but you never hear from him. It's you are only getting the replies to his letters. And as it was an interesting exercise for me, you know, how can you have a character who's very important who you actually – who never says a word?
Since you were a reviewer for many years, and since you have you received some wonderful reviews for your memoir books, more mixed for the novel now. How's that been?
It's been really tough. The review in the New York Times was not mixed. It was awful.
And Yardley in the Post, I read. He was
kind of
mixed, yeah.
He was mixed. But that's what happens with novels. You know, I've gotten raves and I've gotten slams. And it's interesting. You know, I mean, I was a critic for a long time. You know, if you dish it out, you better be able to take it. What I would say is that the two really negative ones, and unfortunately one was the New York Times, which is the loudest voice, which is, you know, difficult. But, you know, when I had critics working for me, my one rule was you cannot review the restaurant that you wish the chef had opened. You have to review the restaurant the chef wants to open. And I feel like both of those guys reviewed the book they thought I should have read. It was like, how can this woman who's done all this, I mean, in fact, the New York Times review said, you know, where's the politics? Where's the culture? And how can she write a book that's just trying to be entertaining? And I mean, this is an entertainment. It's meant to be.
It wasn't the book you want that you wrote. I mean, they were reviewing a book that was in their mind, maybe. Or
exactly.
It should have been, yeah.
Yeah, that they thought, you know, why didn't she write the book that I wanted her to write?
And it's often how reviewers work, though.
It's not a good way to review. I mean, I'm very proud of this book. I love the fact that, you know, people tell me it takes them away. And that's what I'm trying to do, create an invented world that is so absorbing that for a little while you're in another place. And look, I like happy endings. I just do.
Did you feel misunderstood, though? Obviously you did.
I did. I felt like they weren't reading the book that I wrote. They were reading between the lines.
It took you 3.5 years, too. I mean, you put a lot into this book. I guess you had a book deal with Random House, though. Huh?
I did. I have a mini book deal with Random House.
How many more to go?
4.
Wow. Okay. Getting some comments here. Let me read them. Nancy says, could you ask Ruth Reichel to talk about all the crazy, trendy things like foams and deconstructed beef sinews and non-traditional cooking methods, even things like chopped up insects? Is a lot of this because the chefs are bored?
No, it is not because the chefs are bored. It's because the chefs are creative. And, I mean, this is another thing. You know, it's a big kitchen. There's room for lots of things. We have been throwing protein on fire for most of human history. And I find it very exciting that some chefs in this time when we're, you know, walking on the moon are saying, what else can we do with food? Can we pull it apart and put it together in new ways? And I don't want to do that myself, but I love to see what other people do with it. And I find it really exciting. And as for insects, we better start eating insects. It's a very good source of protein that's out there. There's lots of it.
This will make you feel good. Liz in Walnut Creek writes, last Wednesday I bought Miss Reichel's book, Delicious. Couldn't put it down and finished it Thursday afternoon. Her characters are so beautifully written. I wanted more. I hope she will consider a sequel because the characters made me want to know how their lives were going. Is there a story behind the cake recipe referred to in the book and included at the end?
The story is I thought gingerbread would be something that a very precocious child would figure out how to make a better gingerbread. And I love gingerbread. And thank you, Liz. That felt great. And I am working on another. I've just finished a cookbook, which I've turned in. I'm working on my next novel. I had not thought about doing a sequel, but I have to say my Australian publisher is begging me to do a sequel to Delicious. And I'm starting to really miss my characters, and I'm starting to wonder, you know, what's Sammy doing now?
Oh, that whimsical sound in your voice. You go back to them. I think you'll be going back to them. You've been doing a cooking show on PBS, too.
Well,
you did.
I did. I mean, it wasn't really a cooking show. It was a dream. It was my last year at Gourmet. We did a TV show where I went around the world taking cooking lessons in cooking schools in places like Laos and China and Brazil and Venice. And it was one of the most fun things I've ever done in my life. And I went with great people, Frances McDormand and Tom Skerritt and Diane Wiest. I mean, I got Lauren Bracco. I got to go with great people, and it was very fun.
What fun, yeah. Talking again, if you've just joined us, with Ruth Reichel, and she has a novel out now called Delicious, food writer discovering a stash of World War II era letters between a 12-year-old girl and the legendary chef James Beard. And we're talking about all kinds of matters of food, and we welcome your involvement. In fact, Marissa Endicott is standing by for your phone calls, so feel free to join us at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786, or email us, forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, which is kqed.org/forum. Here's a website comment from Kiyoshi, who writes, "Foodies always talk about eating foods of animal protein without regard to the animal that perished to provide that moment of gastronomical pleasure as a right of living. What about the rights of the former living animal?" You hear this a lot, don't you?
I hear that a lot, and I would say, you know, I eat humanely raised animals. And I'm going to get back on my hobby horse here, but it upsets me that we worry more about the animals than we do about the rights of the people who are cutting up the animals in meatpacking plants, who are picking our vegetables. One of my new causes is workers' rights, food workers' rights.
Which are really human rights when you come right down to it.
Which are human rights, but farm workers in New York State, they don't have the right to collective bargaining. They don't have the right to a day off. They don't have the right to overtime. That's wrong. And we need to start worrying about – I mean, it's great that we worry about the animals, but we should also worry about the people.
Here's Caroline, who asks, "In Northern California, Slow Food YOLO is bringing young farmers and young chefs together, inviting people to tour small farms and eat local food prepared by young chefs. I like this. Maybe the young will get eating more in sync with what we can sustainably grow."
Well, that the thing that gives me the most hope about the future of American food is young people. I mean, we have now have a generation who understand that eating is an ethical act, and they're the ones who are going to change the way things are raised, cooked, and eaten in this country. And there is hope.
Where do you stand on, since we're getting into some of your political positions and hobby horses here, but where do you stand on sea bass and other fish that are really threatened? They're endangered, you know, and there are lists that come out, Monterey Aquarium puts them out and says, don't necessarily eat this particular fish because it's imperiled.
Well, I mean, that's an easy one. I mean, do we really want to gobble up everything in the ocean? We've already gobbled up most of the big fish in the ocean, and it's crazy. I mean, the way we fish now, they don't have a chance. I mean, we go after them with sonar, and we identify every one of them. And absolutely, you know, start eating what are known as trash fish. I mean, there are lots of fish that are sustainable, and we should be eating those. We should, you know, do you really want to be eating the last bluefin tuna on the planet? I don't think so.
We go to your calls. Eugene, good morning. Welcome.
Yes, Ms. Reichel, I'm a great admirer. I miss Gourmet, obviously. The influence of Elizabeth David on your writing and your life, actually. She was a great influence on my life.
I actually wrote the introduction to the last...
I have that, yes.
Yeah.
When you went to the dinner party.
Yes. Elizabeth David was remarkable, and it's a puzzle to me that she's not better known in America. I mean, Elizabeth David is kind of Julia Child, Chuck Williams, James Beard rolled up into one for the English. She virtually transformed the cooking of England. And she was a wonderful, wild woman. I mean, she was such an interesting person. And her recipe, I love her recipes because she sort of demands that you use your intelligence. They're very much not like American recipes are written, where she just kind of gives you a suggestion, you know, here, take this, take these ingredients and put them together. And you have to kind of work it out for yourself. But, you know, she's very much about fresh produce and Mediterranean food, and her writing is beautiful. And thank you for bringing her up.
Yeah, thank you for the call. And speaking about beautiful food writing, I suspect, like you, is quite an admirer of MFK Fisher.
Oh, MFK Fisher was a huge influence on me. And in fact, she was the reason I ultimately went to work at a newspaper, because I did a profile of her for Ms. Magazine in, like, I don't know, 79 or 80. And I got to, she was very generous with me and got to know her. And I just admired her and her writing so much. And at one point she said to me, you need to go work at a newspaper. You are polishing every word, and you need to work someplace where an editor says to you, I need 600 words in the next hour. And you write 600 words, and they may not be the best 600 words, but you need that discipline. And and that's why I went to the LA Times, and she was absolutely right.
That was, when was New West? Because I think that's when we first met.
That's when we first met. I wrote for New West from 77 until 84 when I went to the LA Times.
And we'll go to another caller, and that's you, Andrea. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was a big fan of Gourmet Magazine and of Ruth Reichel. And sometimes when I create something out of the refrigerator, I'll pull it out and I'll say, okay, we're having a Ruth Reichel's mother's recipe for dinner tonight. Even though you said your mom wasn't a good cook, I happen to love cooking, so it's kind of just a little joke. But anyway, I was very, very shocked when Gourmet, I mean, clothes. I couldn't believe it. And I've followed you since then, too, and I always enjoy hearing you. And I love that you talked about MFK Fisher and Elizabeth David, because I still have a cookbook of Elizabeth David's, a little paperback from the 60s. So, anyway, well, good luck to you, and I'll follow you, and I'm going to get your book.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
and I'm
Andrea,
sure your everything stew is way better than my mother's.
Let me bring another caller on from Oakland. Celeste, that's you. Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Ruth, I was at the City Arts and Lecture talk last night, and I promised my friend Jim, who's just picked up Garlic and Sapphires, that I would ask you if you remember his favorite bar cookie from the Swallow restaurant 40 years ago.
Which were they, Harvest Bars?
I don't. Maybe that's it. Would it be in your recipe book, the book?
No, it is not, because I wrote before I was at the Swallow.
Okay, so Harvest Bars, did they have lots of nuts in them?
They did.
what's the recipe?
You know, I will try and find it. I will try and find it, or if I can't find it, I'll work it out, and I will post it on RuthReichel.com, but probably not for a couple of weeks, because I'm just in a different city every day right now.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And
it's
I've
Tuesday.
Got
it must
big
be San
bonus points from that. So, and he's been telling me stories from Garlic and Sapphire, so I'm looking forward to reading that as well as Delicious.
Well, thank you
thank
for
you.
The call. Speaking about your website, here's Molly who writes, I still feel bereft from the loss of Gourmet Magazine. I'm planning an al fresco dinner over Memorial Day weekend, and as is my habit, leaf through my old Gourmet magazines for ideas. I settled on a recipe for fava bean crostini from May 2009. Can Ruth please mention her favorite websites for recipes for the quality similar to Gourmet Magazine?
I promised last night.
Oh, by the way, that's arugula, in fact, fava bean, I should mention. Yeah.
Fava bean arugula?
Arugula and fava bean crostini.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's a recipe of Maggie Ruggiero's, I believe.
Why? What a memory you have.
It was a very good recipe. I am going to post on my website in the next few days a list of my favorite food sites. I mean, there are so many of them, and there are so many people who are really doing a remarkable job on their websites. You know, they beautiful pictures, really nice writing. It's a very large world. So I promise that will come soon.
Here's Bonnie, who writes, I started cooking professionally at the age of 13. I cooked my way through New York's best restaurants where I grew up, working 6 days a week, 10 to 12 hours a day, and loved every minute of it. I moved to the Bay Area. Having a baby changed everything. I returned to work after my first, but in the middle of the second pregnancy, my son developed asthma while I was working 70-plus hours a week. My husband was a partner in a law firm and made more money. One of our schedules had to give. It was obvious it would be mine. I stopped working for 8 years and returned to help Berkeley USD food program off the ground and turn it into what it is today, made from scratch foods, fresh, whole foods, not processed. This job was a stroke of good luck. I can work the hours from 5 a.m. to 2 p.m. and then go on to be mom full-time. I'm tired a lot of the time, but at least I'm around to raise my kids. Whereas restaurant jobs are inhospitable for women, this job is inhospitable to men. It just doesn't pay enough to be the primary income for a family. And then she ends, food for thought.
Absolutely. I was actually at a panel a couple months ago for Cherry Bomb magazine. It was all women chefs. And Gabrielle Hamilton from Prune in New York and Suzanne Gowen from Luke in L.A. talked about being mothers and chefs. And basically what they both said is, you know, we just
never feel, the twain shall meet.
We just feel guilty all the time. Yeah. Whatever we're doing, we should be doing the other.
Feel, you know, guilty when they're a chef and they feel guilty when they're a mother because
yes,
they're not doing the work. But this is true for so many jobs for women.
Well, that's true. Yeah. And we need, as a nation, we need to solve this problem. Women work.
Laura writes, I was lucky enough to grow up on my grandmother's ravioli chard and meat filling with porcini sauce from the Parma province of Italy. Would like to try the suckling pig ravioli that were so wonderful for Ruth. Could she please repeat the name of the restaurant mentioned?
I ate it at Catonia, but I believe that it actually – Catonia is the sister restaurant to Quince. And I think that it was something that was snuck out of the kitchen from Quince. But they are both wonderful restaurants.
And then we go to another caller. Is your name pronounced Yumi or Yummy?
Yumi.
Oh, okay. Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Appropriate. Yeah, I just wondered, with the interest of influencing our younger generation, is there any way we can change or have the school lunch programs improved in our states?
Well, there are so many people working on this. I mean, it really started with Alice Waters and the Edible Schoolyard, but there are chefs in every city in America who are working on improving school food. It's one of Michelle Obama's real issues. I think that it's going to be a slow change because, you know, again, it's about money. We have to, as a nation, agree that teaching children to eat well should be an important part of every school curriculum. Eating is learned behavior. And, you know, we need to teach children to eat well at a very young age.
And I thank the caller. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. I want to go to more web postings. Here's Pete who writes, we finally got a recipe here. Speaking of foraging and gingerbread, have you tried the latter with whipped cream infused with dried candy cap mushrooms? Simply mix a heaping teaspoon of powdered candy caps, toss 6 to 8 in a spice grinder into a pint of heavy whipping cream. Leave it in the fridge there overnight, in the fridge overnight, and whip in the usual manner, sweetening with a little maple syrup instead of sugar.
Sounds fantastic. I will try it.
Irene writes, thank you, Ruth and Michael, for making time to have this nuanced conversation of length, covering much of the big kitchen, some of the gourmet issues we have kept years and years on, help shape our travels and to most wonderful experiences. Love your voice in person as well as print. Your enthusiasm and kindness are so engaging in helping people have a reasonable involvement in how they eat and how that food is created.
Boy, I love San Francisco.
You love my listeners because they love you. Here's Rachel from Sebastopol. Hi, Rachel.
Hi there. I'm curious how a professional chef feels about the idea that, like in Water for Chocolate, when you cook something in a good mood or a sexy mood or some mood, it affects the meal. What do you have to say about that as far as a professional chef preparing meal?
Well, okay. That's magical realism, but you're not a professional chef.
I was going to say, I am not a professional chef. I mean, I have never taken any kind of cooking. I mean, I'm an enthusiastic home cook.
But you did manage a restaurant. So did you notice any? And in fact, Rachel, you can call in tomorrow. Daniel Patterson will be on.
He can answer that better than I can. But I mean, I think as a home cook, certainly when you're in a good mood, you probably make better food than when you're in a bad mood. When you're banging around the kitchen in a hurry, you're probably not making food that's quite so delicious.
Thank you for the call, Rachel. And here's Andrea, who asks, why is it that so many of the national magazines, morning shows, and Food Network shows seem to pander to the lowest common denominator and only, or at least primarily, feature the most plebeian cooks, many of whom aren't even trained chefs on the shows? Think Rachel Ray, Ray Drummond, Mark Bittman, etc. It's the same old, all the time. Why not give some of the more brilliant up-and-coming chefs a chance to share with the national audience their amazing skills? I hear that many of these celebrity chefs are on contract with the morning shows, and that's why they're always on the shows.
Well, I think you've just said it all. I don't know that I have anything to add to that, but I agree that, you know, I wish that more of every media took more chances and supported more new talent. It is easier to just go with the tried and true. I mean, I think one of the problems with Gourmet was we, you know, for the advertisers, I don't think for the audience, but for the advertisers, they felt like we took too many chances.
Well, that was, I guess, the problem, wasn't it? the advertisers not necessarily coming around as they should have. But it's so difficult now. I mean, even in the business you used to be in the newspaper business, they're still trying to find ways to monetize on the net, and I mean on the internet, and just don't know what to do with it, you know.
And you know, it's easier to just go with what has always been successful. That's not how you make great media, though. It just isn't.
Good note to end on. So good to have you here once again, Ruth Reichel. Her new novel is called Delicious, and she'll be at the Commonwealth Club tonight at 7 p.m. and at the Ashman Family Center, JCC, in Palo Alto. Can be at both places at once?
No, that is the Commonwealth Club in Palo Alto. That's where it's happening.
Oh, the Commonwealth Club event is at the Ashman. There's a Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, too.
No, this is the one in Palo Alto.
And tomorrow, make that one event. Tomorrow, 6:30 at Omnivore Books in San Francisco. Again, really good to see you.
Oh, this was great. Thanks.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and hours repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. We want to also thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi and Tina Larberg, and our engineer is Danny Bringer. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.